that I sang as badly as any of them. Once I got so carried away that I went and sang into the electric fan when we got home. It made my voice buzz and waver like a slide guitar, an effect I particularly liked. Mama complained it gave her a headache and would give me an earache if I didn't cut it out. "What the hell is she doing?" Daddy Glenn acted like I was singing just to make him mad. "She trying to take the paint off the walls or just sour the milk?" He reached past the fan for me with one of his big hands. "Glenn," Mama's voice was soft, but it stopped him. He looked at her like she had stuck a needle in his heart. "You shouldn't encourage her," he told Mama. "Gonna have her thinking she can do any damn thing she pleases, and then where will we be? Hell, she's out running the county every afternoon as it is."
Mama put her arm around Daddy Glenn's waist. "I know you worry, but trust me, honey. I know where Bone is every minute. I wouldn't let nothing happen to my little girl."
Daddy Glenn relaxed under Mama's touch until he was almost smiling.
"Bone, get your daddy some iced tea," she told me, "and put some extra sugar in it like he likes." I got the tea, and then a washcloth so Mama could cool Daddy Glenn's neck while they sat together.
Mama didn't look at me once the whole time, but Daddy Glenn did, his eyes sliding over me like I was a new creature, something he hadn't figured out yet how to tame. It had been a long time since he had caught me alone, and sometimes I could almost convince myself that he had never held me tight to his hips, never put his hands down inside my clothes. I pretended it had all been a bad dream that would never come back. But I was careful to stay away from him. I ran off before Daddy Glenn could ask for anything more, and took the fan out on the back porch. I sang to myself as softly as I could, humming into the motor, thinking about how gospel singers were always on the road. Even if I didn't get to be the star, I might wind up singing background in a family, all of us dressed alike in electric blue fringed blouses with silver embroidery, traveling in a big bus, and calling home from different cities. But it would be better to be a soloist and be in demand all the time. All I needed was a chance to turn my soulful black eyes on a tent full of believers, sing out the little break in my mournful voice. I knew I could make them love me. There was a secret to it, but I would find it out. If they could do it to me, I would find a way to do it to the world.
"Bullshit and apple butter," Granny laughed cruelly when I finally told her about watching the morning gospel singers and wanting to be like them. "You got to be joking, Bone. You can't sing, girl. You can't sing at all."
"Not now," I admitted grudgingly, "but I'm working on it. I'm gonna get better.
And think about it, Granny. Think about what it would be like."
"Oh, I know."
Granny's expression became gentle, her voice careful. "I know the power of gospel singers. Some of these Christian women will believe anything for the sake of a gospel singer. Anything." I loved the way she said that. Granny's Christian women came out like new spit on a dusty morning, pure and precious and deeply satisfying. "Anything," I echoed, and she gave me her toothless, twisted grin. We were sitting close together in Mama's lawn chairs in the backyard. Granny always complained about Mama not living in houses with porches and rocking chairs, but she liked Mama's reclining lawn chair. Now she reached out, put her hand on the back of my neck, squeezed, and laughed.
"You gotta look like your granddaddy sometimes."
She pinched me and laughed again.
"Bastard was meaner than a snake, but he had his ways. Didn't I love his ways? Lord Christ."
She leaned back and rolled the snuff around in her mouth.
"Man had only two faults I couldn't abide. Wouldn't work to save his life, and couldn't stay away from gospel singers. Used to stand out back of revival tents, offering them the best homemade whiskey in Greenville County. Then he'd bring me that slush they cleaned out of the taps. Bastard."
She stiffened and looked back over her shoulder, afraid Mama might be listening. Mama didn't allow anybody to use that word in her house.
"Well, shit," she spit to the side. "You got a little of that crap, too, don't you? Little of that silliness, that revival crap.
Cousin Temple says you a heathen."
"Oh, Temple, huh. Temple's a pure damn fool.
I said nothing.
Granny wiped her chin. Don't you go telling your mama everything you hear.
No, ma'am.
Now don't you go taking that gospel stuff seriously. It's nice to clean you out now and then, but it ain't for real. It's like bad whiskey. Run through you fast and leave you with a pain.
She wiped her chin again and sighed like she'd taken to doing lately.
I hated that sigh.
I liked her better when she was being mean. When she started sighing, she was likely to start crying. Then her face would squeeze down on itself in a way that scared me.
I ain't no fool.
I rocked back and forth in my chair, pushing off hard with my bare feet. Granny's face twitched, and I saw the light come back into her eyes.
You know how your mama feels about that word.
It was true. Mama had given me one of her rare scoldings for calling Reese a fool. She hated it almost as much as bastard.
Ain't no fool, and ain't no bastard.
I rocked steadily, watching Granny's face. Granny laughed and looked back over her shoulder nervously.
Oh, you gonna be the death of your mama. And won't I be sorry then?
She didn't look sorry. She looked better. I said it again.
Ain't no fool and ain't no bastard.
Granny started laughing so hard she choked on her snuff.
You're both. And you just silly about that music. Just like your granddaddy.
She sounded like she might strangle from laughing.
And goddamn, he was both too.
My gospel thing did get on Mama's nerves after a while, but Aunt Alma reassured her.
It's obnoxious but normal, Annie, and you know it. Every girl in the family gets religion sooner or later.
Mama nodded absently. She wasn't so sure it was that simple. Mama almost never went to church, but she took God and most issues of faith absolutely seriously.
Oh, Annie's a Christian woman,
Uncle Earl told Aunt Alma the morning after the night Mama threw him out for puking liquor on her kitchen table.
But she wears me down being so stubborn all the time. You'd think she never took a drink of whiskey or chased no good-looking man in her life.
She's just as stiff-necked as she can be,
Cousin Dee Dee agreed. She was supposed to be with Aunt Ruth, but seemed to be over at Alma's or Raylene's more than she was home.
You know, Bone, your mama's the kind gets us all in trouble to begin with. Like something out of one of them stories they tell in Sunday school. Supposed to be a lesson to the rest of us.
She smirked at me.
Ask for nothing. Trust in God. Do the right thing.
Right. And he'll send you bastards and rabies before he's through.
I hate, Dee Dee swore, the very notion of a Christian woman with her hard-scrubbed, starved, thin, stiff, and scrawny neck.
She hates herself, Mama told us when Reese repeated what Dee Dee had said,
and I don't know that God has much of anything to do with it.
She gave me one of those sharp, almost frightening looks she seemed to have developed over the summer.
People don't do right because of the fear of God or love of him. You do the right thing because the world doesn't make sense if you don't.
I no longer accepted everything Mama told me as gospel, but I knew what she meant. Doing the right thing shouldn't have anything to do with like or love or goodness or Jesus.
Though most people swore Jesus had something to do with everything.
I knew Mama believed in Jesus well enough, even though she wouldn't talk about it. And I decided that deep in her heart, she understood exactly what I was doing. I gave myself over to the mystery of Jesus' blood, reading the Bible at the kitchen table after dinner, and going to the Wednesday night services for young people.
Mama said nothing. Reese teased me, and Daddy Glenn sneered. Aunt Alma thought the whole thing was funny.
Well, at least she ain't copying Bible passages out and hiding them in your drawers like my Temple did.
You just got to let her ride it out. When Temple got it, I teased her a little, and the girl nearly took my head off.
Almost had the preacher out to talk to me,
as if I wasn't a good Baptist.
Just because I don't see no reason to go to church every Sunday of my life.
But you should go to church, I told Aunt Alma imperviously.
She made me mad talking like I wasn't serious about my faith.
You should witness your faith and get Uncle Earl to go with you. He thinks the world of you, and he'd listen to you if you talked to him right. If I started talking to Earl about Sunday morning church services and witnessing for our faith, he'd think I'd lost my mind. Alma laughed and pinched my chin. You go for us, girl. You witness. If the world really is gonna end tomorrow, I'd rather save you than any of those drunken uncles of yours. And don't you even try to talk Jesus to Earl. That man is impossible to talk to about God and religion. I took Aunt Alma's warning as a challenge and started talking to Uncle Earl about faith and good works. I played him Mama's most tearful gospel country music and repeated all the most dramatic soul-saving stories I'd found in the pamphlets the Christian Ladies' Aid Society passed out. Earl loved the whole thing, my sincerity, the Bible verses, and the thinly veiled threats of perdition. But most of all, he loved the argument. While I tried to prove to him that God was love and Jesus saved, he set out to prove to me that the world was irredeemably corrupt. Never mind the 99. Let's talk about the poor lost sheep in this county, Uncle Earl would start off. One shot glass of whiskey and a tall glass of beer, and he was ready to address the issue of Jesus, only occasionally reminding me of his wife, Teresa. He blamed the loss of Teresa on Jesus, naturally. Jesus who made Catholics, Catholics who were so particular on the subject of fornication and made it so hard for a decent Baptist man to get a divorce. He was funny about Catholics, damning them for making his life so difficult and admiring them at the same time. At least, he told me, Catholics are interesting. Got all that up and down stuff. Chanting, velvet carpet on the pews, and real watered wine for communion. What the hell Baptists got? Grape juice communions, silly rules against dancing and movies, self-righteousness by the barrel full. Damn fool preachers in shiny suits, and simple-minded parishioners. Baptists could learn something from the Catholics. Sometimes in his arguments, Uncle Earl would get Teresa, the Catholic Church, and the county marshals a little confused. Given enough whiskey, he'd start talking about the way they had all united to blight his life. If there was a God, Earl had decided, he was on the side of Teresa, the Catholics, and the Marshals. But there was no God, Earl told me. No God and no hope in churches. People were better off learning to rely on themselves and each other, instead of running around praying for what they weren't going to get. I gave up churches. All churches, because I saw what they were, he told me. Take a look at those oil color paintings on the wall of every Sunday school in South Carolina. Jesus in the mountains, Jesus in the desert, Jesus against the night sky. Jesus got the lost one in his arms. Jesus wants you, each and every one of you. He'll climb the mountains, walk the hot sands, brave the night winds, search among the many for the one not found. And you are never so valuable as when you stand outside the fold, the one God wants. Oh, don't I know? Don't I know? They want you. Oh, yes, they want you. Till they get you. Ain't nothing in this world more useless than a hard-working religious fool. It ain't that you get religion. Religion gets you, and then milks you dry. Won't let you drink a little whiskey. Won't let you make no fat-ass girls grin and giggle. Won't let you do a damn thing except for work for what you'll get in the hereafter. I live in the here and now, and I need my sleep on a Sunday morning. But I'll tell you, Bone, I like it that they want me. Catholics and Baptists and Church of Gods and Methodists and Seventh-day Adventists, all of them hungry for my dirty white hide, my pitiful human soul. Hell, none of them would give two drops of piss for me if I was already part of their saggy-ass congregations. Uncle Earl would drink and swing back his glossy black hair. The more he drank, the more he would talk. Perversely, the more he talked, the more I wanted to hear, though every word out of his mouth was blasphemy. What I really liked was how he talked about Jesus. He talked about Jesus in a way I understood, even when I couldn't put it together with all he said. He talked about Jesus like a man dying for need of him, but too stubborn to sit down to the meal spread within reach. Earl talked the language of gospel music, with its rhythms and intensity. I heard in his drawled pronouncements the same thing I heard when I listened to the music,
the desperation-swelling, rough, raw voices. The red-faced men and pale, sweating women moaning in the back pews. Lord, Lord! Moaning and wailing, wailing and praying, to be washed, Lord Jesus, washed in the blood of the Lamb. The hunger, the lust, and the yearning were palpable. I understood that hunger, as I understood nothing else, though I could not tell if what I truly hungered for was God or love or absolution. Salvation was complicated. I put my hand on Earl's forearm and felt with a dizzy sensation how tight and hot the skin was, as if every muscle in his body was fighting off God. If I had not been so certain of his prospects of hellfire and damnation, it would have tickled my pride to see what a challenge to God's patience Earl managed to be. As it was, all I could think was how marvelous it would be when he finally heard God speaking through me and felt Jesus come into his life. I tried to do all I could to save my poor uncles from their heathen ways, but when I tried to get them to go to Sunday services, Earl just laughed at me. Neville grunted, and Uncle Beau worked himself into a coughing fit. "Goddamn women and their goddamn church-going ways," Uncle Beau yelled at Granny, as if she had put me up to it. "A man don't have to have God on his ass to know what he should do. A man don't need a woman preaching at him all the time." "Stop cursing like that," Granny told him mildly enough. "You're the biggest fool in Greenville County, and it ain't the women made you who you are. You've been after somebody to blame your life on since you was born." She spit snuff and told me to get out of the house and into the sunshine. I didn't argue with her. If I got balky, she was sure to make me squeeze up a piece of her leg when she had to take her insulin shot. She always made me do it when she was angry at me, which was plenty of reason to keep her from getting mad. "If God lived in a whiskey bottle," I heard Granny tell Uncle Beau as I headed out the door, "he'd have filled up your heart a long time ago. But he don't. And you ain't never gonna be saved. So keep your nastiness to yourself." Uncle Earl got work building a carport and took some of the money to get Mama a little electric record player and 4 records. "That's all I'm giving for free," he told her, scooping up gravy with one of her biscuits. "I even bought you some of those old June Carter songs you like. What's that funny one? Nickelodeon, right?" He scooped and sopped and drank sweet tea down like it was whiskey. Mama said he'd eaten so many of her biscuits by now, he was like a child of her own. "A man belongs to the woman that feeds him." "Bullshit," Aunt Alma insisted. "It's the other way around, and you know it. It's the woman belongs to the one she feeds." "Maybe, maybe." Out of those 4 records, there was only one Mama liked, and she damn near wore it out. "The Sign on the Highway," it was called, and after a while, I could sing it from memory. "The sign on the highway, the scene of the crash. The people pulled over to let the hearse pass. Their bodies were found neath the signboard that read, 'Beer, wine, and whiskey, for sale just ahead.'" What surprised me was that Mama, who wouldn't go to church and never even said Jesus' name, had the same response to that music I did. She cried every time she heard it, and she wanted to hear it all the time. It was a gospel song, of course, a kind of gospel song. Mama would play it over and over, and I'd come in to sit with her while she listened. Her with a glass of tea in one hand and the other over her eyes, and me as close to her as she'd let me be. Both of us crying quietly, and then smiling at each other and playing it again. Uncle Earl would come in and laugh at us. "Look at you two. You just as crazy as you can be. Look at you, crying over some people didn't never really die. That's only a slide guitar, and some stupid folks can't make a living no other way, except acting the fool in front of people like you." He stomped off out the screen door, while Mama wiped her face and I sat still. He kicked each step as he went down. "I swear this family's got shit for brains." Since I was getting nowhere saving my uncles, I fell back on the only capital I had, my own soul. I became fascinated with the idea of being saved. not just welcoming Jesus into my heart, but the seriousness of the struggle between salvation and damnation, between good and evil, life and death. God and the devil were the ultimate arbiters, and everyone knew what was being fought over. It was just like Uncle Earl had told me. If you were not saved, not part of the congregation, you were all anyone could see at the invocation. There was something heady and enthralling about being the object of all that attention. It was like singing gospel on the television with the audience following your every breath. I could not resist it. I came close to being saved about 14 times. 14 Sundays in 14 different Baptist churches. I didn't fake my indecision. The teary-eyed intensity and open-mouthed confusion that overtook me when the preacher turned his glance on me. There was something about the way his face looked when he cried out for all those who felt the call to come forward. Something in the way the old woman in the front pew turned around to look up and down the aisles. The music would come up, and the choir would start half-humming, half-singing, softly and tenderly, "Jesus is calling." And a pulse would start to throb in my temples. Tears would pearl up in the corners of my eyes, and my tongue would seem to swell in my mouth. I wanted something. Jesus or God or orange blossom scent or dark chocolate terror in my throat. Something hurt me, ached in me. I couldn't tell if it was the music or the eyes or the waxed smell of the hardwood floors. But everything ran together and drew me down the aisle to the front pew, where the preacher put his hand on my head and some stiff-necked old woman came forward to hold my hand. Once there, I would cry silently and hold on while a few other people came down too. Then we would all pray together. I could not have explained, but it was not actually baptism I wanted, or welcome to the congregation, or even the breathless concentration of the preacher. It was that moment of sitting on the line between salvation and damnation, with the preacher and the old woman pulling bodily at my poor, darkened soul. I wanted that moment to go on forever. Wanted the choir to go on with that low, slow music. I wanted the church to fill up with everyone I knew. I wanted the way I felt to mean something, and for everything in my life to change because of it. When the music stopped, and the sweaty preacher sat down with his little notebook to talk to me, my face would go rigid, and my voice would sink to a whisper of shame and nervous terror. Every time that moment was the same. The smell of watery ammonia would blot out the orange blossoms, and whatever old woman was hugging me would flake pancake makeup on my bare arms. I would start to gag and have to run off to the girls' room in the basement to wash my face. Then I would stare into my eyes in the mirror and know I wasn't ready. It wasn't right. The magic I knew was supposed to wash over me with Jesus' blood was absent. The moment cold and empty. I would stumble out into the sunshine guiltily, still unsaved, and go on to a new church the next Sunday. I'd begun to think about trying out the Church of God or the Holy Church of Jesus' Disciples when Mama caught on to me. She took me to Aunt Ruth's church at Bushy Creek and had me baptized beneath the painting of Jesus at the Jordan. When my head went under, my throat closed up, and my ears went deaf. With cloudy water soaking my dress and my eyes tight shut, I couldn't hear the choir or feel the preacher's bruising grip. Whatever magic Jesus' grace promised, I didn't feel it. I pushed up out of that dirty water, shivering, broke out in a sweat, and felt my fever rise. I sneezed and coughed for a solid week, lying limp in my bed and crying to every gospel song that came over the radio. It was as if I were mourning the loss of something I never really had. I sang along with the music and prayed for all I was worth. Jesus' blood and country music. There had to be something else, something more to hope for. I bit my lip and went back to reading the book of Revelation, taking comfort in the hope of the apocalypse, God's retribution on the wicked. I liked Revelations, loved the Whore of Babylon and the promised rivers of blood and fire. It struck me like gospel music. It promised vindication. Chapter 11. I recognized Shannon Pearl immediately on the first Monday of the school year. I'd seen her with her family at the revival tent. Her daddy booked singers for the circuit, and her mama managed the Christian Bookstore, a religious supply store downtown south of Main Street, a place where you could get embossed Bibles, bookmarks with the 23rd Psalm in blue relief, hot plates featuring the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus and that damned lamb on everything imaginable. Slipcovers, tablecloths, even plastic pants to go over baby diapers. Shannon got on the bus two stops after Reese and me, walking stolidly past a dozen hooting boys and another dozen flushed and whispering girls. As she made her way up the aisle, I watched each boy slide to the end of his seat to block her sitting with him, and every girl flinch away as if whatever Shannon had might be catching. In the seat ahead of us, Danny Yarborough leaned far over into the aisle and began to make retching noises. "Cootie train! Cootie train!" somebody yelled as the bus lurched into motion, and Shannon still hadn't found a seat. I watched her face, impassive, self-sufficient, and stubborn. She reminded me of myself, or at least the way I had come to think of myself. Sweat was showing through her dress, but nothing showed in her face except for the eyes. There was fire in those pink eyes, a deep fire I recognized, banked and raging. Before I knew what I'd done, I was on my feet and leaning forward to catch her arm. I pulled her into our row without a word. Reese stared at me like I was crazy, but Shannon settled herself and started cleaning her bottle glass lenses as if nothing at all was happening. I glared at Danny Yarborough's open mouth until he turned away from us. Reese pulled a strand of her lank, blonde hair into her mouth and pretended she was sitting alone. Slowly, the boys sitting near us turned their heads and began to mutter to each other. There was one soft cootie bitch hissed in my direction, but no yelling. Nobody knew exactly why I had taken a shine to Shannon, but Reese and I were back at Greenville Elementary, and everyone there knew me and my family, particularly my cousins Gray and Garvey, who would toss you against a wall if they heard you insult any of us. Shannon Pearl spent a good 5 minutes cleaning her glasses and then sat silent for the rest of the ride to school. I understood intuitively that she would not say anything, would in fact generously pretend to have fallen into our seat. I sat there beside her, watching the pinched faces of my classmates as they kept looking back toward us. Just the way they stared made me forget all my newly made vows to behave like a good Christian. Their contemptuous, angry faces made me want to start a conversation with Shannon and shock them all. I almost grinned, imagining Shannon and me discussing all the enemies we had in common, while half the bus craned their necks to hear. But I couldn't bring myself to do that. Couldn't even think what I would say to her. Not till the bus crossed the railroad tracks at the south corner of Greenville Elementary did I manage to force my mouth open enough to say my name and then Reese's. She nodded impartially and whispered, "Shannon Pearl," before taking off her glasses to begin cleaning them all over again. With her glasses off, she half shut her eyes and hunched her shoulders. Much later, I would realize that she cleaned her glasses whenever she needed a quiet moment to regain her composure, or more often, just to put everything around her at a distance. Without glasses, the world became a soft blur. But she also behaved as if the glasses were all that made it possible for her to hear. Commotion or insults never seemed to register at all when she was cleaning her glasses. It was a valuable trick when you were the object of as much ridicule as she was. 6 inches shorter than me, Shannon had the white skin, white hair, and pale pink eyes of an albino, though her mama insisted Shannon was no such thing.
"My own precious angel is just a miracle child," Mrs. Pearl declared. "Born too soon, you know. Why, she was so frail at birth, we never thought the Lord would let her stay with us. But now look at her. In my Shannon, you can just see how God touches us all."
Shannon's fine blue blood vessels shone against the ivory of her scalp. "Blue threads under the linen," her mama was always saying. Sometimes, Shannon seemed strangely beautiful to me, as she surely was to her mother. Sometimes, but not often. Not often at all. Every chance she could get, Mrs. Pearl would sit her daughter between her knees and purr over that gossamer hair and puffy pale skin.
"My little angel,"
she would croon, and my stomach would push up against my heart. It was a lesson in the power of love. Looking back at me from between her mother's legs, Shannon was wholly monstrous, a lurching, hunched creature shining with sweat and smug satisfaction. There had to be something wrong with me, I was sure, the way I went from awe to disgust where Shannon was concerned. When Shannon sat between her mama's legs or chewed licorice strings her daddy held out for her, I purely hated her. But when other people would look at her scornfully, or the boys up at Lee Highway would call her lard eyes, I felt a fierce and protective love, as if she were more my sister than Reese. I felt as if I belonged to her in a funny kind of way, as if her affliction put me deeply in her debt. It was a mystery, I guessed. A sign of grace, like Aunt Maybelle was always talking about. Magic. Christian charity, I knew, would have had me smile at Shannon, but avoid her like everyone else. It wasn't Christian charity that made me give her a seat on the bus, trade my fifth-grade picture for hers, sit at the kitchen table while her mama tried another experiment on her wispy hair.
"Egg and cornmeal, that'll do the trick. We gonna put curls in this hair, darling, or my name ain't Roseanne Pearl."
Or follow her to the Bushy Creek Highway store and share the blue popsicles she bought us. My fascination with her felt more like the restlessness that made me worry the scabs on my ankles. As disgusting as it seemed, I couldn't put away the need to scratch my ankles or hang around what Granny called that strange and ugly child. Other people had no such confusion about Shannon. Besides her mother and me, no one could stand her. No amount of Jesus' grace would make her even marginally acceptable, and people had been known to suddenly lose their lunch from the sight of the clammy sheen of her skin, her skull showing blue-white through the thin, colorless hair, and those watery pink eyes flicking back and forth, drifting in and out of focus.
"Lord, but that child is ugly!"
"It's a trial, Jesus knows, a trial for her poor parents. They should keep her at home."
"Now, honey, that's not like you. Remember, the Lord loves a charitable heart."
"I don't care. The Lord didn't intend me to get nauseous in the middle of Sunday services. That child is a shock to the digestion." I had the idea that because she was so ugly on the outside, it was only reasonable that Shannon would turn out to be saint-like when you got to know her. That was the way it would have been in any storybook the local ladies' society would let me borrow. I thought of Little Women, the Bobbsey twins, and all those novels about poor British families at Christmas. Tiny Tim, for Christ's sake. Shannon, I was sure, would be like that. A patient and gentle soul had to be hidden behind those pale, sweaty features. She would be generous, insightful, understanding, and wise beyond her years. She would be the friend I had always needed. That she was none of these things was something I could never quite accept. Once she relaxed with me, Shannon invariably told horrible stories, most of which were about the gruesome deaths of innocent children. "And then the tractor backed up over him, cutting his body in three pieces. But nobody seen it or heard it, you see, 'cause of the noise the thresher made. So then his mama come out with iced tea for everybody, and she put her foot down right in his little torn open stomach. And oh, Lord, don't you know?" I couldn't help myself. I kept going over to Shannon's house to sit and listen, open-mouthed and fascinated, while this shining creature went on and on about decapitations, mutilations, murder, and mayhem. Her stories were remarkable. Not fantasies like the ones I made up. Shannon's stories had the aura of the real, newspaper headlines and autopsy reports, and she loved best little children who had fallen in the way of large machines. It was something none of the grown-ups knew a thing about, though once in a while I'd hear a much shorter, much tamer version of one of Shannon's stories from her mama. At those moments, Shannon would give me a grin of smug pride. "Can't I tell it better?" she seemed to be saying. Gradually, I admitted to myself what hid behind Shannon's impassive pink and white features. Shannon Pearl simply and completely hated everyone who had ever hurt her,
and spent most of her time brooding on punishments either she or God would visit on them. The fire that burned in her eyes was the fire of outrage. Had she been stronger or smarter, Shannon Pearl would have been dangerous. But half-blind, sickly, and ostracized, she was not much of a threat to anyone.
Mr. and Mrs. Pearl were as short as Shannon was, and almost as pale. Neither of them trusted their fine complexions to the sun's glare. Mr. Pearl always wore a dark worsted fedora and a suit to match. Mrs. Pearl stayed in the store out of the sun and wore both a hat and gloves whenever she went out. They always looked secretive and self-contained, their prim mouths shut tight. It was impossible to imagine them naked, stepping out of their baths or pressing their pulpy bodies close together in the privacy of their bedroom. They looked like children dressed in their parents' clothes, and their various enterprises seemed to mean no way for grown people to make a living. Mrs. Pearl admitted they never quite covered Shannon's medical expenses, so they took up collections from sympathetic congregations. I couldn't imagine asking strangers to pay your bills, but I didn't say anything. I was so careful with the Pearls, so quiet and restrained and politely attentive, I might have been a cousin of theirs. It was worth it to me to play at being one of them. With Shannon and her family, I finally got to meet the people I'd dreamed about. The Blue Ridge Mountain Boys, the Tuckerton family, the Carter family, little Pammy Gleason, blessed by God, the Smoky Mountain Boys, and now and then, every time he'd get saved, Johnny Cash. Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Wednesday prayer service, revival weeks. Mr. Pearl would book a hall, a church, or a local TV program. Because I was Shannon's friend, I got to go on the tours, to meet the stars of both the country western and gospel circuits. That was enough to stop me worrying about my fascination with Shannon. I could easily credit the whole enterprise to my odd but acceptable lust for gospel music. Shannon knew the words to every song in the Baptist hymnal and spoke familiarly of every gospel group that toured the Opry circuit. Gospel was her family's life, and she knew all there was to know about it, though she didn't seem to feel the music's impact the way I did. Shannon made fun of preachers and choir singers, telling her most devastating jokes about the Hallelujah Jumpers, who completely lost consciousness of themselves when they sang and began to spring up on the balls of their feet, swinging their arms in the air. I could never have told her my secret ambition, never have told her that I cried when I listened to tent shows on the radio late at night.
"Those eyes of yours could break the heart of God," Mrs. Pearl told me as she patted my black hair fiercely.
I blinked and tried to tear up for her.
"Lashes, oh, Bob, look at the lashes on this child. You grow up, you can do Maybelline commercials on the television, honey. Course, not that you're going to want to. You don't ever let anybody talk you into putting any of that junk on you. Your eyes are a gift from God."
She leaned close to my shoulder and put one hand on the top of my head, turning me so that I looked directly into her eyes. Her caramel brown pupils were enormous flat surfaces that reflected nothing. Her voice was honey-coated and sincere. I could not tell if she was making fun of me or speaking from her heart.
"Mama has more ways of saying God and Jesus than any preacher I've ever heard."
Shannon blinked her pink eyelids at me.
"She's got a talent for it, talking real soft and low one minute, saying God, so that you can see him in your mind like some kind of old family relation. All quiet and well-mannered like an old man. Or she can drag it out long and loud, God, and just shock you senseless. When she really gets going, she's got this hollow-sounding moan that just about rocks you off your feet.
Her Jesus is even better. Everybody says Jesus so much round here, you forget sometimes who he was supposed to be. But Mama rations her Jesuses. You hear her say, Jesus, the way she does, and you know for sure that Jesus was a real person. That little boy used to bring doves back to life. That quiet young man never known to curse or fornicate. You can just see him, a man, like your daddy, maybe, aged by the sins of the world, a life sacrificed for you personally."
Shannon cackled her raspy laugh.
I tell you, I couldn't stand it when I was little. But I got used to it as I got older. Now I love it. People getting all pale and nervous when Mama starts talking about God.
The bookstore never made any money. It was Mrs. Pearl's specialty sewing that was the backbone of the Pearl family income. Not surprisingly, she was famous for gilt-rendered scenes on the costumed sleeves and jackets of gospel performers. I got to where I could spot a Mrs. Pearl creation on the sunrise gospel hour without even trying. She had a way of putting little curlicues at the base of the cross that was supposed to suggest grass. But for everyone who knew her, it was an artist's signature. There was no doubt that Mrs. Pearl loved her work.
"I feel like my whole life is a joy to the Lord," she told me one day, surrounded by her sewing machines and racks of embroidery thread. She was knotting tassels on a red silk blouse for one of the younger Carter girls. "My sewing, Mr. Pearl's work, the store, my precious daughter."
She glanced over at Shannon with a look that mirrored the close-up of Mary and the baby in the center of the illustrated Christian Bible that was always on special down at the store.
"Everything that comes to us is a blessing or a test. That's all you need to know in this life. Just the certainty that God's got his eye on you, that he knows what you are made of, what you need to grow on. Why, questioning's a sin. It's pointless. He will show you your path in his own good time, and as long as I remember that, I'm fine. It's like that song Mr. Pearl likes so much. Jesus is the engineer, trust his hand on the throttle."
Shannon giggled and waved me out on the porch.
"Sometimes Mama needs a little hand on her throttle. You know what I mean."
She laughed and rolled her eyes like a broken Cupid doll.
"Daddy has to throttle her back down to a human level, or she'd take off like a helium angel."
I couldn't help myself. I laughed back, remembering what Aunt Raylene had said about Mrs. Pearl. If she'd been fucked right just once, she'd have never birthed that weird child. I poked Shannon on one swollen arm, just in case she could read behind my eyes.
"Your mama's an angel," I whispered hoarsely, mocking the way Mrs. Pearl would say it. "Just an angel of God."
"Goddamn right," Shannon whispered back,
and I saw her hatred burning pink and hot in those eyes. It scared and fascinated me. Was it possible she could see the same thing in my eyes? Did I have that much hate in me? I looked back at Mrs. Pearl, humming around the pins in her mouth. A kind of chill went through me. Did I hate Mrs. Pearl? I looked at their porch, the baby's breath hanging in baskets, and the two rocking chairs with hand-sewn cushions. Shannon's teeth flashed sunlight into my eyes.
"You look like the devil's walking on your grave."
I shivered and then spit like Granny. "The grave I lie in ain't been dug yet." It was something I'd heard Granny say. Shannon grabbed my arm and gave it a jerk.
"Don't say that. It's bad luck to mention your own grave. They say my grandmother McRae joked about her burying place on Easter morning and fell down dead at evening service."
She jerked my arm again, hard.
"Think about something else, quick."
I looked down at her hand on my arm, puffy white fingers gripping my thin brown wrist.
"That child will rot fast when she goes,"
Aunt Raylene had said once. I felt sick. I got to go home. I pulled air in fast as I could. "Mama wants me to help her hang out the laundry this afternoon."
"Your mama's always making you work." "And yours never does," I thought.
"I like your family," Shannon sometimes said, though I knew that was a polite lie. "Your mama's a fine woman,"
Roseanne Pearl would agree. I in my two tight, raggedy dresses. She reminded me of the way James Waddell looked at us, of his daughter's smug, superior faces. Laughing at my mama's loose teeth and Reese's curls done up in paper scraps. Daddy Glenn was still working for the Sunshine Dairy and continued to take us over to his father's or one of his brothers every few weeks, though they never seemed any happier to see us. Their contempt had worn my skin thin, and I had no patience for it. Whenever the Pearls talked about my people, I'd take off and not go back for weeks. Now I took a deep breath, trying to get my stomach under control. Sometimes I really couldn't stand Shannon.
We're gonna go to the diner for supper tonight. They have peach cobbler this time of year.
My daddy's gonna make fresh ice cream tonight.
Shannon smiled a smile full of the pride of family position.
We got black walnuts to put on it.
I didn't say anything. She would. She would rot very fast.
The gospel circuit ran from North Carolina to South Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama. The singers moved back and forth on it, a tide of gilt and fringed jackets that paralleled and intersected the country western circuit. Sometimes you couldn't tell the difference, and as times got harder, certainly Mr. Pearl stopped making distinctions, booking any act that would get him a little cash up front. More and more, Mama sent me off with the Pearls in their old yellow DeSoto, the trunk stuffed with boxes of religious supplies and Mrs. Pearl's sewing machine, the back seat crowded with Shannon and me and piles of sewing. We would pull into small towns in the afternoon so Mr. Pearl could do the setup, and Mrs. Pearl could repair tears and frayed embroidery, while Shannon and I went off to picnic alone on cold chicken and chow chow. Mrs. Pearl always brought tea in a mason jar, but Shannon would rub her eyes and complain of a headache until her mama gave in and bought us RC Colas. Most of the singers arrived late. It was a wonder to me that the truth never seemed to register with Mr. and Mrs. Pearl. No matter who fell over the boxes backstage, they never caught on that the whole Tuckerton family had to be pointed in the direction of the microphones, nor that little Pammy Gleason,
Lord, just 13,
had to wear her frilly blouse long-sleeved because she had bruises all up and down her arms from that red-headed boy her daddy wouldn't let her marry.
They never seemed to see all the boys passing bourbon in paper cups backstage, or their angel daughter begging for just a sip. Maybe Jesus shielded their eyes the way he kept old Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego safe in the fiery furnace. Certainly sin didn't touch them the way it did Shannon and me. Both of us had learned to walk carefully backstage, with all those hands reaching out to stroke our thighs and pinch the nipples we barely had.
Playful boys,
Mrs. Pearl would laugh, stitching the sleeves back on their jackets, mending the rips in their pants. I was amazed that she couldn't smell the whiskey breath set deep in her fine embroidery, but I wasn't about to commit the sin of telling her what God surely didn't intend her to know.
Sometimes you think Mama's simple, Shannon said one night, giggling oddly.
I wished she would shut up and the music would start. I was still hungry. Mrs. Pearl had packed less food than usual, and Mama had told me I was always to leave something on my plate when I ate with Shannon. I wasn't supposed to make the Pearls think they had to feed me. Not that that particular tactic worked. I'd left half a biscuit, and damned if Shannon hadn't popped it in her mouth.
Maybe it's all that tugging at her throttle,
Shannon giggled again, and I knew somebody had finally given her a pull at a paper cup.
Now, I thought, now her mama will have to see.
But when Shannon fell over her sewing machine, Mrs. Pearl just laid her down with a wet rag on her forehead.
It's the weather,
she whispered to me over Shannon's sodden brow. It was so hot that Jesus and the lamb were wilting off the paper fans provided by the local funeral home. But I knew if there had been a snow up to the hubcaps, Mrs. Pearl would have said it was the chill in the air. An hour later, one of the Tuckerton cousins spilled a paper cup on Mrs. Pearl's sleeve, and I saw her take a deep, painful breath. Catching my eye, she just said,
"Can't expect that frail soul to cope without a little help."
I didn't tell her that it seemed to me that all those boys and girls were getting a hell of a lot of help. I just muttered an almost inaudible, "Yeah," and cut my sinful eyes at them all. If they'd let me sing, I'd never shame myself like that.
We could go sit under the stage, Shannon suggested. It's real nice under there.
It was nice, close and dark and full of the sound of people stomping on the stage. I put my head back and let the dust drift down on my face, enjoying the feeling of being safe and hidden, away from the crowd. The music seemed to be vibrating in my bones.
Taking your measure, taking your measure. Jesus and the Holy Ghost are taking your measure.
I didn't like the new music they were singing. It was a little too gimmicky. 2 cups, 3 cups, 1 teaspoon of righteousness. How will you measure when they call out your name? Shannon started laughing. She put her arms around me and rocked her head back and forth. The music was too loud, and I could smell whiskey all around us. Suddenly, my head hurt terribly. The smell of Shannon's hair was making me sick. Desperately, I pushed Shannon away and crawled for the side of the stage as fast as I could, gagging. Air. I had to have air. I rolled out from under the stage and hit the side of the tent. Retching now, I jerked up the tarp and wiggled through. Out in the damp evening air, I let my head hang down and vomited between my spread hands. Behind me, Shannon was gasping and giggling. You're sick, you poor baby. I felt her patting the small of my back comfortingly.
Lord God!
I looked up. A very tall man in a purple shirt was standing in front of me. I dropped my head and puked again. He had silver boots with cracked heels. I watched him step back out of range.
Lord God!
It's all right.
Shannon got to her feet beside me, keeping her hand on my back.
She's just a little sick.
She paused.
If you got her a Coca-Cola, it might settle her stomach.
I wiped my mouth, then wiped my hand on the grass. I looked up again. Shannon was standing still, sweat running down into her eyes and making her blink. I could see she was hoping for 2 Cokes. The man was still standing there with his mouth hanging open, a look of shock on his face.
Lord God,
he said again, and I knew before he spoke what he was going to say. It wasn't me who'd surprised him.
Child, you are the ugliest thing I have ever seen.
Shannon froze. Her mouth fell open, and her whole face seemed to cave in as I watched. Her eyes shrank to little dots. Her mouth became a cup of sorrow. I pushed myself up.
You bastard!
I staggered forward, and he backed up, rocking on his little silver heels.
You goddamn gutless son of a bitch!
His eyes kept moving from my face to Shannon's wilting figure.
You think you so pretty, you ugly sack of shit? You shit-faced, turd-eating—
Shannon Pearl!
Mrs. Pearl was coming around the tent.
You girls!
She gathered Shannon up in her arms.
Where have you been?
The man backed further away. I was breathing through my mouth, though I no longer felt so sick. I felt angry and helpless, and I was trying hard not to cry. Mrs. Pearl clucked between her teeth and stroked Shannon's limp hair.
What have you been doing?
Shannon moaned and buried her face in her mama's dress. Mrs. Pearl turned to me.
What were you saying?
Her eyes glittered in the arc lights from the front of the tent. I wiped my mouth again and said nothing. Mrs. Pearl looked to the man in the purple shirt. The confusion on her face seemed to melt and quickly became a blur of excitement and interest.
I hope they weren't bothering you,
she told him.
Don't you go on next?
Yeah.
He looked like he wasn't sure. He couldn't take his eyes off Shannon. He shook himself.
You Mrs. Pearl?
Why, that's right.
Mrs. Pearl's face was glowing.
I've heard about you. I just never met your daughter before.
Mrs. Pearl seemed to shiver all over, then catch herself. Pressed to her mama's stomach, Shannon began to wail.
Shannon, what are you going on for?
She pushed her daughter away from her side and pulled out a blue embroidered handkerchief to wipe her face.
I think we all kind of surprised each other.
The man stepped forward and gave Mrs. Pearl a slow smile, but his eyes kept wandering back to Shannon. I wiped my mouth again and stopped myself from spitting. Mrs. Pearl went on stroking her daughter's face, but looking up into the man's eyes.
I love it when you sing,
she said, and half giggled. Shannon pulled away from her and stared up at them both. The hate in her face was terrible. For a moment, I loved her with all my heart.
Well, the man said. He rocked from one boot to the other. Well,
I reached for Shannon's hand. She slapped mine away. Her face was blazing. I felt as if a great fire was burning close to me, using up all the oxygen, making me pant to catch my breath. I laced the fingers of my hands together and tilted my head back to look up at the stars. If there was a God, then there would be justice. If there was justice, then Shannon and I would make them all burn. We walked away from the tent toward Mr. Pearl's battered DeSoto.
Someday, Shannon whispered.
Yeah, I whispered back. Someday.
Driving backcountry with Mr. Pearl when he went on his prospecting trips meant stopping in at little rural churches with gospel choirs, shabby tents with a soloist or two, and occasional living room prayer meetings that might shelter an extraordinary young singer. Following up Mr. Pearl's trips was extended, tedious work requiring great patience and tact. All too many of the singers couldn't sing at all, and hadn't an ear good enough to know when they went off tune. A few were enthusiastic enough that Mr. Pearl cautiously encouraged them to try out for one of the existing gospel groups, but mostly all he found was an echo of the real stuff. A diluted blend of harmony and aspiration.
Pitiful, ain't it?
Shannon sounded like her father's daughter.
That sad old organ music just can't stand against a slide guitar.
I nodded reluctantly. I still wanted to believe that spirit, determination, and hard work could lift even the most pedestrian voice into the rarefied atmosphere of heartfelt gospel music. There was no predicting who the hand of God might touch, where the clarion would sound. Sometimes one pure voice would stand out, one little girl, one set of brothers whose eyes would lift when they sang. Those were the ones who could make you want to scream low against all darkness in the world.
That one, Shannon would whisper smugly.
But I didn't need her to tell me. I always knew who Mr. Pearl would take aside and invite over to Gaston for revival week.
Child, he'd say, you got a gift from God.
Uh-huh, yeah. Sometimes I couldn't stand it. I couldn't go in one more church, hear one more choir. Never mind loving the music. Why hadn't God given me a voice? I hadn't asked for thick eyelashes. I had asked for, begged for, gospel. Didn't God give a good goddamn what I wanted? If he'd take bastards into heaven, how come he couldn't put me in front of those hot lights and all that dispensation? Gospel singers always had money in their pockets, another bottle under their seats. Gospel singers had love and safety and the whole wide world to fall back on. Women and church and red clay solid under their feet. All I wanted, I whispered, all I wanted was a piece, a little piece of it. Shannon overheard and looked at me sympathetically.
She knows, I thought. She knows what it is to want what you are never going to have.
I'd underestimated her. That July, we went over to the other side of Lake Greenwood, a part of the county I knew from visiting one of the cousins who worked at the airbase. Off the highway, we stopped at a service station to give Mrs. Pearl a little relief from the heat.
You ever think God maybe didn't intend us to travel on Sunday afternoon? I swear he makes it hotter than Saturday or Friday.
Mrs. Pearl sat in the shade while Mr. Pearl went off to lecture the man who rented out the Rhythm Ranch. Shannon and I cut off across a field to check out the headstones near a stand of cottonwood. We loved to read the mottos and take back the good ones from Mrs. Pearl to stitch up on samplers and sell in the store. My favorites were the weird ones, like, Now He Knows, or Too Pure. Shannon loved the ones they put up for babies, little curly-headed dolls with angel wings and heartbreaking lines like, Gone to Mama, or Gone Home.
Silly stuff.
I kicked at the pieces of clay pot that were lying everywhere. Shannon turned to me, and I saw tears on her cheeks.
No, it just tears me up, thinking about it. Losing your own little baby girl, your own little angel? Oh, I can't stand it. I just can't stand it.
She gave big, satisfied sobs and wiped her hands on her blue gingham pockets.
I wish I could take me one of these home.
Wouldn't you like to have one you could keep up
You could tell stories to the babies.
You crazy. Shannon sniffed. You just don't understand. Mama